We sleep better when we sleep cool. As the weather is getting warmer, staying cool while we sleep will be top of mind. Organic and natural bedding sleeps cooler than cheaper synthetic alternatives, and they last longer too. A fresh season calls for a fresh start, and that includes your bed. From seriously soft organic cotton sheets to breathable silk and luxurious down duvets, Avocado Green's bedding makes it easy to reset your space sustainably. Perfect for hot sleepers in warmer months, Avocado Green sheets and duvet inserts are naturally breathable and help regulate temperature, so you sleep cool, dry, and comfortable all night long. Avocado bedding is thoughtfully designed and expertly crafted for lasting durability. From reinforced stitching to premium long staple organic fibers, every detail is made to stand the test of time, wash after wash, season after season. We sleep better when we sleep cool, so head to avocadomattress.com today to save 10% on all bedding and 50% on clearance bedding. Avocado, dream of better. Let me tell you about the online cannabis company that's revolutionizing how we deal with life's challenges, from sleepless nights to stress-filled days. Mood.com has created an entire line of functional gummies that target specific health concerns with 100% federally legal THC blends that they'll deliver discreetly right to your doorstep. And you can get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with promo code ATTWG. It is wild how different each one of their gummies feels. Their sleepy time gummies knock me out in about 15 minutes flat with no hangovers, no grogginess, and I just wake up feeling amazing. Oh, and the Epic Euphoria gummies, they're perfect for those days when nothing's going right and you just need to hit the reset button on your crap mood. What makes these different is how they pair THC and other cannabinoids with herbs and adaptogens. You're not going to just find gummies like this in a dispensary, or anywhere for that matter. And they have gummies for literally everything. Immune support, menopause relief, PMS symptoms, mental clarity, and sexual arousal. And each one is crafted using federally legal cannabis grown on small, family-owned American farms. No pesticides, no BS, and they can ship to most states in the U.S. Best of all, not only does Mood stand behind everything with an industry-leading 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but, as I mentioned, listeners get 20% off their first order with code ATTWG. So head to Mood.com, browse their amazing selection of functional gummies, and find the perfect gummy for whatever you're dealing with. And remember to use promo code ATTWG at checkout to save 20% on your first order. Remember when I talked about True Diagnostics' True Age Test? Well, I took it myself and the results blew my mind. I was very wrong. If you remember, I was worried about my brain and not my cardiovascular health. And it turns out, my brain's fine, but my cardiovascular health needs work. But luckily, my biological age was really right on track with my actual age, which is good because research shows that if your biological age is even just 5 years older than your actual age, your risk of developing diseases like cancer or heart disease can jump by as much as 30 to 50%. That's a big deal, and it's completely avoidable. The good news is nearly 90% of biological aging is in your hands. It's driven by things like your lifestyle, your habits, and the environment you're in, which means that you have a lot of control over it. The True Age test didn't just give me a number. It showed how quickly my heart, brain, liver, and immune system are aging, and it was eye-opening. And I will say, I definitely picked up the workouts after I learned that my cardiovascular health isn't as good as I thought it was. The test itself was super easy and convenient. I did it from home, and it was just a quick, painless finger prick that I made Ethan do because I was too scared. You send it off in a tiny sample in a prepaid package, and in about 2 to 3 weeks, you'll get a detailed online report about your aging and health. So if you care about protecting your health and want to find out what your real age is, head over to truediagnostic.com and use my code ATTWG to get 20% off your entire order or subscription. That's truediagnostic.com and use ATTWG at checkout to get 20% off. Your future self will thank you. An entrepreneurial 12-year-old wanted to earn money to buy a dirt bike, so he started delivering newspapers. On Sunday, September 5th, 1982, Johnny Gosch loaded up his red wagon with copies of the Des Moines Register and set off on his early morning route. Johnny was usually accompanied by his father, but this morning he only had his dog with him. The people on his route all knew Johnny and his family, so when they hadn't gotten their Sunday paper by around 7 a.m., some customers started calling the Gosch home. Johnny's father went out to find his son, but instead of the 12-year-old, he found only the red wagon and the family dog. Now, nearly 40 years later, the case has become infamous and has bred multiple conspiracy theories going up to the top levels of U.S. government, and has left people still passionately debating what happened to Johnny Gosch. When a person goes missing, there's a special kind of pain in the not knowing. I want to tell you the stories of those who never came home. I want to tell you the story of Johnny Gosch. I'm Kona Gallagher.
And I'm Ethan Flick.
And this is And Then They Were Gone. Welcome back, everyone.
Welcome back.
All right. Thank you for joining us once again. This one is quite a doozy. The Johnny Gosch case has been the subject of multiple books, documentaries, podcasts, blogs, message board threads, everything. We've had sightings. We've had conspiracy theories. I mean, just all of it.
And unsurprisingly, I know nothing about this.
Yeah, unsurprisingly. So this is going to be a two-part episode, but not only is it going to be a two-part episode, it's going to be our two-part season two finale. Thank you to everybody who, you know, has stuck with us so far in season two. We're going to take a little bit of a break after these next two episodes. It's getting to be the holiday season and we have three kids and family and whatnot. And it just tends to get a little crazy around this time of year. It won't be as crazy as it was last year when we were buying a house around this time.
That is very true.
Yeah, and moving and doing all of that. So, you know, we did have quite a long hiatus between our first and second seasons. So this one will definitely be shorter than that. But we do need a little bit of time to kind of, you know, relax and regroup. But now let's get into part one of the Johnny Gosch story. John David Gosch was born on November 12, 1969, to Noreen and John Gosch. John was Noreen's second husband. Her first husband and the father of her two oldest children died of cancer. When Noreen and John married, he adopted her children and the couple had Johnny. The Gosch family lived in a nice upper-middle-class neighborhood in Des Moines, Iowa, and it seemed like they had a typical late 70s, early 80s Midwestern life. I mean, like, this kid saved up at 12 to buy a dirt bike. You don't see a lot of that nowadays, at least not around our area.
Yeah, no. Most of the kids in our area, their parents just buy them stuff.
And it's not dirt bikes generally.
Yeah, that's true.
So by September of 1982, Johnny had had his paper route for a while. He had a red wagon that he would carry the newspapers in, and he was generally accompanied by his father and the family's dog, a dachshund named Gretchen. But Johnny was a 12-year-old boy, almost 13, and he was ready for a little more independence. So on Saturday night, September 4th, Johnny asked his parents if he could do his paper route by himself the next morning. Apparently, his dad initially said it was okay, but Noreen, quickly overruled him, and then both parents said that it was no-go.
Oh, is this deep into the 80s, every child gets taken kind of thing?
No, not at all. And in this, actually, and we'll talk about this a lot more, especially in our second episode, but this is actually one of the cases that really leads to the stranger danger panic of the 1980s, because this was 1982 and Eaton Patz had gone missing in New York in 1979. That was the first kind of really big one. And it was just starting to happen. So Johnny Gosch, this is 1982. And then there's some other cases, including Jacob Wetterling in 1989, that really contributed to it. But yeah, this is definitely one of the seminal cases that started the Stranger Danger panic.
Yeah, I mean, I remember growing up and like just assuming or it being drilled into our heads that if you're out alone as a child, you are going to get kidnapped.
Like 100%. Yeah.
And obviously, none of my friends got kidnapped and we were out by ourselves all the time. But it was very much in my face as a kid.
Yeah. And I think in, you know, Noreen's situation, the reason she said no wasn't because of that. It was just more of Johnny left the house at 5:45 in the morning.
Yeah.
You know, right. Like,
yeah, that's pretty early.
Yeah. And so I just think that she wasn't in love with the idea of him doing that by himself. But, you know, he did tons of other stuff by himself. And the fact that he had a paper route in general, you know, and he was one of many, many kids his age who did this exact same thing. So there are kids all over the place, you know, working these jobs in their town back then. But yeah, so anyway, so he wanted to do it on his own, you know, because it seems like it was kind of split, right? Like some of the kids would be accompanied by their parents, but some wouldn't be. And so Johnny wanted to do it, but parents said no. But Johnny apparently did not let that stop him. And so when his alarm went off the next morning and he left the house at 5:48 a.m., he just didn't wake his dad up.
Oh.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, so then Johnny headed out to the paper drop as normal, where he picked up the papers for his route. He was seen there by other kids, other newspaper carriers, and other parents. And everything seemed, you know, totally normal. Like, again, because not every kid was accompanied by their parents, like it wasn't completely strange that sure. Johnny was there by himself.
Yeah.
But shortly thereafter, a few neighbors did notice something strange. A man named John Rossi was at the newspaper drop to get papers for his kids to deliver, and he saw Johnny speaking to a man in a blue car. They described it later as like a Ford Fairlane, and it could possibly have a silver stripe going across it, but kind of reports differ on that. According to Rossi, the man pulled up next to Johnny as he was pulling his wagon near the corner of 42nd Street and Ashworth Road. He then drove off and pulled a U-turn on Ashworth and parked on the corner. He spoke to Johnny again and allegedly asked for directions to 86th Street. And at this point, John Rossi was basically right there. So he was interviewed in the documentary, Who Took Johnny? And he said basically like the second time that the guy spoke to him and he was asking for directions, Johnny called over to him, to John Rossi, and was like, oh, hey, this guy needs directions to 86th Street or whatever.
Yeah, because why would you be asking a kid for directions?
Exactly. Like, yeah, when there's an adult right there, right? Like, it makes sense to ask a paper boy for directions because you think they do know the area, right? Because they're delivering and sure. 86th Street was not far away. But yeah, there was an adult right there. But John said in the documentary that like as soon as he, you know, kind of came over, the guy started acting weird and took off. Hmm. But before he took off, I mean, he got close and he got a look at the guy. And he said that the guy was acting weird. Like, not that he was drunk, but like maybe he was high, like kind of hyped up a little bit. He didn't seem sleepy like everybody else did at 6 a.m. He was also described as being in his mid-30s and about 200 pounds with dark hair, deep-set eyes, and a dark complexion. The timeline of this whole morning is kind of all over the place, but all of this apparently happened sometime between 6 and 7 a.m., and then by about 7, Johnny's customers started calling his house, wondering where their papers were. Johnny's dad then went out to find Johnny and, you know, see what the deal was and probably like yell at him for
not
leaving,
waking him up.
Right.
Yeah.
But instead of his son, he found Johnny's red wagon filled with every single one of his newspapers about 2 blocks from their house.
Hmm.
Both Johnny and his yellow newspaper carrying bag were gone. Gretchen, the mini dachshund, eventually made her way back home. What happens next kind of varies. Like, In the documentary, they made it seem like they immediately called police. But I've read newspaper accounts that said that Johnny's dad didn't immediately like panic. And he actually took the wagon and went and delivered the papers himself. And then when he was finished and Johnny still wasn't back, that's when he went home and talked to Noreen and they called the police around 8:30.
I mean, is that what happened? That's what he did? Or
that's what I've read in newspaper accounts. But again, what they said in the documentary differs a little bit. Like they've said different things at different times.
It just seems peculiar if this is Johnny's first time out doing this by himself. It's kind of an odd behavior for the dad to just be like, well, you know, he'll turn up. Let me just go finish the newspaper route. And
it's hard to tell because, you know, even though I did read it in newspaper accounts, like those aren't always completely accurate.
Sure.
You know, yeah. We found, especially in the accounts in the early days of an investigation like this, like timelines definitely get muddled.
Yeah.
So I really just can't say for sure either way. But when they did go back home and call police, police also did not take it very seriously. So the police station was apparently only like 10 blocks away, but it took them 45 minutes to respond after the call. And that slow response time was just the first of many frustrating actions by the West Des Moines Police Department. Because after they finally arrived, the officers were not at all concerned for Johnny's safety, despite, you know, what seems, at least to us, to be kind of alarming circumstances. Noreen says in the Who Took Johnny documentary that they kept asking her, has he run away before?
And there it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Still not okay.
Nope.
I mean, just because a kid's a runaway doesn't mean that they're not in danger.
Yeah, he's 12.
Right.
Like, what is he doing out there that's not terrible, you know? Yeah, so before they even did a single moment of police work, they had already pegged Johnny as a runaway. Adding to that were some issues of the time. Now, this is 1982, so there were no Amber Alerts, no social media,
right.
Nothing that, you know, even if they wanted to, could help them really get the word out quickly and have a far reach, you know, in an immediate kind of way. Like, yes, they can call reporters, put it on the news, whatever, but that takes time.
Right, and you're already talking about, what, a two-hour gap between when he was last seen and when the police basically showed up.
Yeah.
At least two hours.
So, at least, yeah.
I mean, yeah, now you're talking, if you do get media on scene, you're talking another hour. Now we're 3 hours
well,
into
and then
it,
it's going to be the evening news.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
It's not even going to get anywhere till 6 p.m.
Right.
And it's a Sunday. So that you got to take that into consideration as well. And that was another issue. Adding to that, it was also the law in Iowa at the time that you had to wait 72 hours before you could file a missing persons report, even if it was a child.
It makes zero sense.
Yeah, but that was the statute. So, like, that was just what it was at that time. Plus, it was not only Sunday, it was the Sunday of Labor Day weekend. So a lot of police officers and detectives were off for the holiday, and the department was basically working with a skeleton staff. And I mean, you know, like when it's a holiday, like the people with like the higher ranks, like they're gone.
Oh yeah, it's usually the rookies that are working.
Exactly. So like if you're experienced and you're an investigator who's been around the block a few times, like you're barbecuing somewhere, you're not working. All of this is to say that the initial hours, which we know are crucial in a missing persons investigation, were basically wasted. The Goshes saw what was happening very early on, and they're like, okay, this is not good, you know, like, because they're telling them you have to wait 72 hours, he's a runaway, you know, all of these red flags are popping up for these parents. So they immediately took things into their own hands. Like, they formed search parties and took the investigation on themselves. And it's interesting because not only did they call Johnny a runaway right off the bat, but they refused to call this an abduction even days and weeks and months later when Johnny still wasn't coming home. Even in a newspaper article on the one-year anniversary of Johnny's disappearance, police were saying that Johnny disappeared, quote, by suspicious means, but still refused to classify it as an abduction.
Why?
I have no idea. I don't know if there are political or PR or stats reasons for that. Like, I don't know what it would be, but, you know, after a year, like, there's no common sense reason to say that this is not an abduction. Because there's absolutely no evidence saying that it isn't.
Right, but there is, at the very least, a suspicious person that's linked to this that would lead one to believe that it was an abduction.
Well, exactly. And you had multiple witnesses saying, yeah, I saw a weird person, saw a weird car, saw, you know, all this stuff that doesn't lead anybody to believe that Johnny ran away. But by September 8th, Noreen says that she was giving police as much information as she had gathered herself, basically, and they still weren't really doing much with it. She claims that they had been receiving middle-of-the-night hang-up calls in the weeks leading up to Johnny's disappearance. She also claimed that Johnny had what she called a weird interaction with a police officer at a football game the Friday before he went missing. Basically, what had happened was John had given Johnny money to go buy food from the concession stand, but Johnny didn't come back immediately. So John went to go see what was going on, and he saw Johnny on the sidelines talking to a police officer who was working the game. And, you know, that was whatever. He didn't think that was super weird. But later, John saw Johnny sitting in the bleachers talking to the same police officer. Yeah. And it was just it wasn't something that they thought was super worrisome, but it was something that was a little odd. And especially, again, after Johnny's disappearance, you got to think as parents, you're just replaying every single thing in your mind and grasping at anything out of the ordinary.
At that point, yeah, I was just going to say that. Anything out of the ordinary then suddenly becomes suspicious.
Right, and especially because they believe that the police officer they saw talking to their son that night looked similar to one of the sketches that was made from witness statements of the man who was seen talking to Johnny on the day he disappeared.
In the blue car.
Yeah. In a letter to the Des Moines Register, they said, quote, "We have been fighting, trying to get the police to get the names of the men who are on duty that night, and they said they couldn't, that it wasn't that important." Well, it is important because this man bears a resemblance to the composite sketch of the last person John Gosch was seen talking to, end quote. Police Chief Orville Cooney refuted the idea that police weren't helping, telling the Register, quote, "There were a total of 10 officers working the game that night. They have seen all but two of them, and we are going to get Polaroids of those two," end quote. And in terms of whatever happened with that, I mean, it kind of died off. That part of the story died off after that. But the idea that the West Des Moines police weren't doing what they needed to be doing to help find Johnny persisted. Within a month, the Gosch family had hired their own private investigator who was tracking down leads that indicated Johnny had been sold to a pedophile ring. They also formed the Johnny Gosch Foundation in order to spread awareness, raise money for their investigation, and to start changing beliefs and attitudes around missing children cases. The Goshes, especially Noreen, were extremely outspoken about how the West Des Moines police were handling the case. They wasted no opportunities to drag them in public. So basically, the relationship between the police and the family was strained from the very beginning.
To say the least.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we're talking from the very beginning.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting to me the way, just people are treated, because she was the mother of a son who was kidnapped and she was doing everything in her power to find him. But she was kind of marked as an hysterical loon early on. The general feeling at the time seemed to be that she should just, sit back and wait for her son to be found.
Or to return on his own because he's a runaway.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it was it's really interesting. In all the news articles that I read, the general vibe from all the police officers, even the FBI, everybody seemed to be I don't know why she's being so crazy. It was really weird.
I guess we could chalk it up to it being a different time.
Yeah. Noreen and John Gosch said that they believed their son was still alive and out there somewhere. Though they did organize searches in the woods and along creeks, they didn't really seem to expect to find a body. And in March of 1983, about 6 months after Johnny's abduction, something major happened that indicated that this belief may just be correct. A woman in Oklahoma said she was approached by a boy who was being chased by two men. She told police that he came up to her and said, quote, "Please, lady, help me. My name is John David Gosch," end quote. She says that one of the men caught up with the boy, twisted his arm behind his back, and dragged him away. And if this next part isn't a sign of the times, then I don't know what is. The woman was obviously extremely disturbed by this incident.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it sounds terrifying. So she called police to report it. But the police said that it was probably a family situation.
Oh, boy.
And dismissed it.
Okay.
Yeah. Given that this was in Oklahoma and Johnny went missing in Iowa.
How long did it take for that information to get back to Iowa?
Oh, yeah. No, probably like a while. And then, but even then, you know, there's a chance that the officers who responded in Oklahoma had never heard of Johnny Gosch, right? So like saying, "My name is John David Gosch," could very well have meant nothing to them.
Right.
But still, like, a terrified child being chased and abused by older men only elicited a shrug and a "mind your business" from the police. So at that point, though, there wasn't really much else that the woman could do. But it, you know, unsurprisingly stuck with her.
Yeah.
So fast forward to that October. Now, this was in March that it happened. So in October, she's sitting at home watching a TV movie about Adam Walsh, John Walsh's son, who was abducted and murdered. At the end of the movie, they showed several pictures of currently missing children. When the woman saw Johnny's photo, she immediately knew that this was the boy who had run up to her back in March.
Wow. So we actually have positive ID on it.
Yeah.
Like, that's crazy.
Yeah, it is. So she went to police again, and it still took a while for anybody to take her seriously. But eventually someone did, and the information made its way back to the Goshes. They put their private investigators on the case. And the investigators, a company called the Investigative Research Agency, also brought in the FBI. A spokesperson from the investigation agency told reporters in January of 1984, quote, "We and the FBI both checked it out and we're both convinced it positively was Johnny," end quote. Now, to be fair, in that same article, a spokesperson from the FBI refused to confirm that, citing an ongoing investigation.
Right, yeah.
So, you know, you do have to take it for what you will. Like,
sure.
We don't have anything directly from the FBI saying, yes, that was Johnny, just from this PI agency saying that the FBI said that, yes, it's Johnny. But at the very least, it's fairly compelling evidence that Johnny was perhaps kidnapped by some sort of pedophile ring and that, you know, Noreen's ideas like weren't completely insane.
Right.
And yeah, at this point, Noreen is 100% convinced that that is, in fact, what happened to Johnny. And his case just starts getting weirder and weirder. In June of 1984, Noreen was contacted by a man who said he was a private investigator based in Des Moines. And again, not weird at all. All sorts of private investigators contacted them, and as well as many, many psychics.
Yeah.
Yeah, like there's a ton of psychics that we don't even need to get into. But this man, this PI, was named Sam Soda. According to Noreen's book and also sworn court testimony, she met with Soda in his office, but again, like by this point, June of 1984, she didn't trust anyone. She just like, she knew she needed to document everything, right? So she brought a tape recorder and she recorded this meeting. During this meeting, Soda told her that there would be a second kidnapping in Des Moines. He even specified that it would occur on the south side of Des Moines, that the victim would be another paperboy, and it would take place on the second weekend in August.
He's an investigator? He's not one of the psychics?
No, he's not one of the psychics. Like, he's a PI.
Telling her that there will be another kidnapping.
Mm-hmm.
What?
Yeah, it was pretty specific. And Noreen's like, what are you, like, how would you know that? And he told her that he had an informant. So she also thought it was very weird that he was telling her all of this instead of going to the police with this information.
Yeah.
So she tried to do that. But they, again, thought she was being hysterical and, like, making up these stories about this pedophile ring and, like, you know, other kidnappings and things like that. So they just ignored her. She also tried to go to the media, but they weren't really interested either. Again, I think a lot of reporters were also kind of taking a step back from her at this point, though they were still covering Johnny's story. However, Des Moines Register reporter Frank Santiago allegedly did listen to the tape. He was basically on the Johnny Gosch beat for the Register. I don't think he ended up publishing anything related to the tape, however. So basically, nothing was publicly known at the time about this tape and potential kidnapping.
Right, but at least we know that she told people about it.
Right.
Like, so there are people that can corroborate that she knew about it.
Yeah, it would seem that way. And sure enough, on August 12th, 1984, a paperboy named Eugene Martin was kidnapped on the south side of Des Moines. The circumstances were almost identical to Johnny's kidnapping. Eugene had gotten his papers, was seen speaking with a man, and then he was just gone. In the 2 years between the two kidnappings, because it was almost 2 years to the day, the Johnny Gosch bill had been passed. So I mentioned that the Goshes started the Johnny Gosch Foundation within a month of his disappearance. So about 42 days before Eugene's kidnapping, this bill got passed. And that directed police to begin missing person searches immediately instead of waiting 72 hours, as had been the law previously.
Missing persons cases across the board or children?
I believe across the board, yeah.
Well, that's good.
Yeah. So because of this, the initial response was much better for Eugene's disappearance than they were for Johnny. And, you know, Noreen definitely did not miss the opportunity to, like, say snarky things about that. Like, being like, listen, I'm very happy for the Martins that they're getting a better response, but I would have loved for Johnny to get this response. That kind of a thing.
Yeah.
But even with this, very few clues were uncovered, and Eugene's case quickly went cold. But weirdly, even with this happening, no one seemed to pay much more attention to Sam Soda.
Yeah. Are the police going to look into this now? Or
no.
No?
But they are interacting with him, but for different reasons. So a few months later, in October, so just 2 months after Eugene Martin's disappearance, Soda ends up bringing down a child molester named Frank Sikora. So, and this is so weird because, again, Johnny Gosch and Eugene Martin were both paper boys for the Des Moines Register. The Des Moines Register is obviously the newspaper that's covering everything. Frank Sikora was a newspaper carrier for the Des Moines Register who used boys as runners to deliver more papers. He pled guilty to two charges of child molestation involving two of his runners. This came after Sam Soda taped Sikora basically confessing and then handed this tape over to police.
Hmm.
Now, after this, Noreen and others started to question why Soda knew so much about Des Moines pedophiles.
Right.
Does he just have really good informants, as he told Noreen, or was he actually involved himself? Again, this is something that Noreen was wondering, but from what I can tell, police didn't really care either way. And they never, like, questioned him or brought him in or nothing in relation to Johnny's case or Eugene's case or anything.
They're just like, hey, good job.
Yeah, you're like, doing, thanks for the tape.
You're doing our job for us.
Yeah.
So keep it up.
Yeah, basically.
Wow.
But Sam Soda stayed on Noreen's radar. Then in 1985, there was another sign that Johnny may still be out there somewhere. A woman in Sioux City, Iowa, was given change at a grocery store. In it was a dollar bill that said, quote, "I am alive, Johnny Gosch," end quote. So the woman saw this, turned it into the authorities, and interestingly, it seems that this piece of evidence was actually taken very seriously. The Treasury Department confirmed that the bill had been in circulation since 1974, and three different handwriting experts said that the signature did in fact belong to Johnny.
I was going to say, you know, at this point, this is now a nationally known case, so reasonable to think that that could have been forged.
Oh, yeah.
But that's interesting. That
it is. It is. And to me, yeah, like, okay, because yes, it's three different handwriting experts, but handwriting, like, that's not a science. Like, it's not.
Sure. Yeah.
So to me, that doesn't say with 100% certainty that it was A, written by Johnny Gosch, and B, it was written by Johnny Gosch after September 5th, 1982. But yeah, it's pretty interesting. The Goschs held a press conference in which they showed a blown up copy of the dollar bill, and they were even accompanied by both of Iowa's senators at the time, Chuck Grassley and Tom Harkin. By this point, Johnny's reward fund had grown to $400,000, and the Goschs said that they would just pay it as ransom. Like, they didn't care, you know? Like, reward for information, if you're the one who kidnapped him, like, we don't care. We will give you $400,000. Just give us our son back. But nobody came forward. Now, during this time, and especially after Noreen kind of started making noise about Sam Soda, the Goschs were victims of pranks, threats, and harassment. People called and claimed to have Johnny and said, you know, give me $10,000, come to the park, there'll be, you know, just like all sorts of elaborate things that were just used to torture them. And the thing about this case is that there were either sightings of Johnny or bizarre things like that dollar bill that would pop up every couple of years, which is just enough to make Johnny's family believe that he was still out there somewhere alive. The next big one came on Valentine's Day of 1988, when Noreen said that she received a typewritten letter in the mail. The letter read in part, quote, "I'll never be permitted to return home. They've cut my hair. They've dyed my hair. I look different. Please don't ever forget me. Love, your son, Johnny Gosch," end quote. Noreen was convinced the letter was from her son because he always signed his letters, "Love, your son, Johnny Gosch." And it was like a family joke because that's such a weird way to sign a letter, right, you know? Yeah. She's like, "We know who you are. You don't have to put your first and your last name, and we know you're our son." Yeah. So, but that was something just odd that he did. And so that was just one of the reasons that she did think that it was from Johnny. Apparently in the letter, he also mentioned that 1983 incident in Oklahoma, which further led her to believe that it was true.
I feel like at this point, most of that would have been put out there.
Yeah, for sure. But, you know, it's interesting because, I mean, yeah, maybe by 1988, because I did read an article about the Oklahoma incident that was published in 84 when it was first made public, but it wasn't made public where it had happened. They did not reveal at first that it was in Oklahoma. They just said another large Midwestern city is where it happened. So I don't know if in 1988 the location was public or not. Two more years passed though with very little movement on the case, but then in 1990, there was a huge bombshell. Someone confessed to taking Johnny.
Oh, okay.
And that's where we're going to end this week. Part two will be out next Wednesday, or if you're a member of our Patreon, you have it in your feed now. We're going to cover everything starting from the confession, but this case is an absolute rat's nest. Like, there is so much that we still won't even have time to delve into depth. I mean, there are just conspiracy theories after conspiracy theories, and it's just, it's crazy. But before we go, I do want to get your general feeling at this point, just hearing what you've heard so far. Like, do you believe these sightings?
Definitely the one where Johnny ran up to the woman and said, you know, my name is,
yeah,
you know, and then the guys like put him in an arm lock and drag him away. That would be, that's hard to let go of. I mean, like at that point, this wasn't national news. At that point in the investigation, it wasn't national news. So like this woman saw it, you know, reported it right away, and then saw Johnny as a missing person on a show later, right?
Yeah, 6 months later.
I mean, definitely that one. I definitely believe that one. The dollar bill, I don't know. I mean, anybody could have written that. I mean, like you said, it doesn't narrow it down to it being in circulation or narrow it down to a time frame.
The dollar bill thing happened in 85. So like if the dollar bill had been printed in 84, you know, then obviously it would not be true, right? But so nothing disproves it.
But it was in circulation since what, 74?
74, I think it was, yeah.
So, I mean, that doesn't give you any kind of time frame on it. Handwriting experts, that lends a certain amount of credibility to it, especially if it was three different ones. Mm-hmm. But as you pointed out, that's not an exact science. So that could have been faked. The letter, I mean, it was typed.
Yeah, that's the problem. That's the thing that bugs me about it.
Yeah, I mean, so obviously anybody could have done it. Him signing "Love Your Son," I don't know if there had been anything, any of his personal letters made public.
Yeah.
You know, like maybe that's something that was picked up on, maybe something that the police were showing or his mom was showing.
I don't think the police were showing much.
Yeah. But I don't know. I mean, just to me, that's not very solid.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, I kind of agree with you on all of that. The thing that bothers me the most about the Oklahoma incident is because of the nature of it, meaning that she reported it immediately, but the cops didn't take her seriously. I doubt that they wrote like a good report about the incident, the initial incident.
Right.
Because what I would like to know, the one thing that would absolutely make me believe it would be if there's some sort of official documentation from that day in March saying this kid came up to me and said, "My name is John David Gosch," right? Because if there isn't that report, I could believe that this very well-meaning woman perhaps had this happen. A kid came up to her, said something, was scared, whatever, it was awful. The police didn't take her seriously. 6 months later, she's watching this show about Adam Walsh and then sees Johnny's picture. It looks like the kid that she saw. And then she thinks, oh, yeah, he told me his name was John. You know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's definitely a possibility. But like you said, it depends. I mean, I would be curious to know if those were the exact words in the report.
Yeah, exactly. The initial report. Yeah, because if that was, because you're right. I mean, if she did in March say, he told me his name was John David Gosch, yes, it's not completely outside of the realm of possibility that she had heard about his case. Like, no, it wasn't national news, but like, you know, I mean, we don't know her life. Like she might have heard about it for some reason, right? In Oklahoma and Iowa, like, you know, they're not that crazy far away from each other. So I don't, but it would really, to me, lend a lot of credence to it. And that could be the case. Like she could have said in March to those police officers, this is what he told me. And it could be 100% real. I just don't know. And they haven't released that detailed information. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that's my only hang up with that sighting. And again, because, you know, yes, the investigative agency says that the FBI told them that it was Johnny, but like, that's just what they said. The FBI didn't say that directly.
Sure.
So that's kind of my feeling on that. You know, as far as the dollar bill goes, I have the same thoughts on it you do. I mean, maybe, maybe not. I really don't know. The typewritten letter. So this kind of goes along with a theory that we're going to talk a little bit more about in the next episode, which is every couple of years, like I mentioned, something seems to happen in this case. Whether it's a sighting, whether it's the dollar bill, whether it's this typewritten letter. And I mean, it keeps on going. Like this is, we're ending right now in 1988. It keeps on going. The next big thing is in 1990. Some people have said that maybe Noreen is creating some of this in order to keep Johnny's name out there, in order to keep people's attention on the case. So maybe the letter is something that she potentially created herself.
Are those the same people that would describe her as a hysterical woman at the beginning of the case?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah. But not exclusively.
Okay.
It's so hard because she is painted in such a negative light for doing what any mother would do in her situation, which is fight for her son.
Right.
So it's really hard to kind of be able to separate what is just general misogyny and what might, you know, be valid.
Yeah. And I'm sure there is a certain amount of hystericalness.
Yeah. I get hysterical over all sorts of stuff.
Yeah. And this is a high pressure, high stress situation. I'm sure on some level she has gone kind of off the deep end, but that doesn't necessarily mean that she would do something that extreme.
Right. No, exactly. And I'm certainly not saying that at all, but I just do think it's fair to bring up the, you know, the point, because like, that's just something that has one of the many weird things that has been kind of surrounding this case over the years.
Mm-hmm.
But like I said, we'll get into that a little bit more in the next episode, because again, these things do keep on happening for the next several years. And again, it's like every couple of years. So this confession that I just mentioned, you know, that takes place 2 years after this letter. In 1990 is when they first hear about it. Technically, it happened in 89, but the Gosch family doesn't hear about it until 1990. So yeah, so that's the next thing. And that is just a whole other can of worms that, if it is to be believed, proves that not only is Johnny's kidnapping connected to a pedophile ring, but many other area kidnappings are as well, and that it extends throughout the Midwest and into the upper echelons of government.
Well, I'll be looking forward to hearing that conspiracy theory.
Yeah, it's quite a doozy. But whatever happened to Johnny Gosch, Noreen and John Gosch have been through absolute hell. Not only did they have the worst thing possible happen to them, but they dealt with years of sightings and letters and hoaxes and threats. And next week, we're going to talk more about false hopes and answers that never materialized. John David Gosch was 5'7" and 140 pounds. He had light brown hair, blue eyes, and freckles. He was last seen wearing a white sweatshirt with Kim's Academy printed on the back, either black sweatpants or cutoff jeans and blue flip-flops. He was 12 years old when he disappeared. He would be 52 today. If you have any information on what happened to Johnny Gosch, please contact the West Des Moines Police Department at 515-223-3211. You can see all the sources for this episode, along with photos and videos, at our website, andthentheyweregone.com.
And be sure to follow us on social and Then They Were Gone Pod on Facebook and at ATTWG Pod on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe and consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It will help new listeners find us. And the more people that listen, the more chances we have of bringing someone home.
And we'll see you here next week for our season finale, part 2 of the Johnny Gosch story. Or we'll see you right now on Patreon.
See you next week.
And Then They Were Gone is hosted by Kona Gallagher and Ethan Flick. All research, writing, and editing is done by Kona Gallagher. Theme music is The Stork by Ketza. Additional music is provided by Kai Engel. And Then They Were Gone is a Little Monster production.
Hey, you can do it!
If you're a lineman in charge of keeping the lights on, Grainger understands that you go to great lengths, and sometimes heights, to ensure the power is always flowing. Which is why you can count on Grainger for professional-grade products and next-day delivery, so you have everything you need to get the job done. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Stop by Sherwin-Williams and get 30% off select paints and stains May 2nd through the 12th. It's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Refresh your home inside and out with colors that make every space feel brand new. From cozy interiors to stunning exteriors, we've got the perfect shade for your next project. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.